Hey y'all, how you doing? Sorry for not uploading in a long time, I guess. I think it's been a long time. All right, I mean, let's say I'm gonna be regular from now on. Every Wednesday I will upload a new episode, okay? So anyway, today I don't know how long the episode's gonna be because I'm more or less gonna be narrating a story of sorts. So it might be kind of a long episode. Plus, I'm like super hungry, so I might like stop in the middle, eat the pizza, come back and narrate. Let's see how it goes. Today I'm going to be talking about cosmic background radiation. Now, you may have ne heard of it, you may have not heard of it at all. You may be somewhere in the middle, like, yeah, sounds familiar. But that's fine, like, whatever stage you are in. Today is going to be more about the history of how it was discovered. And I think there's a lot of value in the history of science. If you ask me, I like it. You know, I like the idea of knowing the people behind these amazing theories that you just read and you take for granted today. I mean, it's there in your high school textbook. You're like, yeah, Hubble's law, whatever. And then you never get to know the mind of this guy. You never get to know his story. What did he want? Why did he enter this field? And what did he struggle with? And what we often forget is that science it's very human. It's very human. It might be the most rational of all fields, and most people think it's this cold subject and oh, scientific laws. But really, it's very human. It is prone to mistakes. It is prone to errors just as much as any other field is. And you know, it does have that human nature to it. And a lot of stories in science, if you look at how things were discovered, it's not like a linear story. It's not like, oh, this guy went into this field, discovered it. Ta-da, Nobel Prize. Not really. There was a lot of miscommunication. There was a lot of conflict between ideas back then. There were people fighting for credit. That also happened. And especially with the story I'm going to talk about, that is the background of the cosmic background, the background of the cosmic background radiation. Yeah. This story in particular, I think, has a lot of fun drama, and there were people like bitching about other people and people not giving references properly and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, talking about why, I think it's kind of obvious to you if you have some amount of intuition for astrophysics and cosmology. You know that cosmology really took birth with this discovery of cosmic background radiation, and it basically didn't even exist before that. Like, we are talking 1960s, and before that, yes, astrophysics definitely was there. It was in a pretty advanced stage as well, but not so much cosmology at all, right? It was not even a field back then, and which is why the CMB is such an important discovery for science. Because we were playing with small objects, and when I mean small, I even mean like stars, perhaps in astrophysics. We went from just looking at things on Earth to predicting planetary motions to being able to understand the fusion process within a star, but that's about it. And then maybe we understood galaxies, right? But then when Hubble came around, and started talking about the expansion of the universe, the fact that there were other galaxies out there just like ours, really, really far away. We didn't even know that. Yeah, we didn't even know that there were other galaxies just like ours. We just assumed the Milky Way was the entire universe. And I think till Hubble, the scientific community had not fully accepted it. Right? So, and around the same age as when, the discovery of the cosmic background radiation changed everything. So let's try to understand a bit of the background. So there was this guy called Gamow, right? Today, you take for granted that the birth of the universe, or the Big Bang, must have been really, really hot. And you ask any 8-year-old, he would tell you that the Big Bang was a hot explosion, like a bomb. And not entirely sure how accurate that visual is, but the point is we take it for granted. So, did we always know this? No, it was not obvious at all. So somebody had to come around and say, okay, wait, how did the Big Bang look like? What were the different parameters? What can I judge sitting here? Can I even say what the temperature could have been at the beginning of the universe? Right? So somebody did come around and ask these questions. So one of these dudes was George Gamow, and he said, okay, let me look at creation, right? Everything you see around you must have been made from stuff that was there at the Big Bang. But if you see large-scale structures today, galaxies, water bottles, giant trees, I mean, all of this must have been put together by subatomic particles, right? So, in order for atoms themselves to form, these subatomic particles must have been forced together. They must have collided, interacted, till the strong nuclear forces kick in, and then they form atoms. So, what conditions at the beginning of the universe would be required for such a transformation? And what he came up with was, okay, it must have been hot. So, it was not an it's not an obvious notion at all. And he had to kind of reverse engineer what he sees today in the universe, and then he came to the inference that the beginning of the universe must have been really hot. And it was hot enough to make these subatomic particles collide and interact, therefore atoms were formed, right? But at the same time, there was an other guy who's going to play a very important role in this story, and his name is Bob Dickey. I do not know entirely how to pronounce his name, but I'm just going to say Bob. All right, I like it, Bob. So Bob was this other guy, and then he also came to the conclusion independently that the Big Bang must have been hot. But he came to this conclusion because of an entirely different train of thoughts. It was a different logic altogether. So while the first guy, Gamow, he thought about creation, this guy, Bob, he thought about destruction. He said, for him, the universe was like a pulsating heart. Okay, for him, he was not satisfied with these answers. Like, when you ask where did the universe come from, people back then would just say, well, it must have come from nothing, or it popped out of nothing, God made it, whatever. So he wanted something that made more sense, and for him, the solution was to say, I think the universe expands and then contracts, and then it expands again and then it contracts. So it's an oscillating, pulsating universe. So in his logic, he was like, in the previous cycle of the universe, obviously there were heavy metals, heavy elements that were made, right? These get manufactured in the bowels of stars, which was already proven by that time. And he was like, okay, so if in the previous cycle of the universe, all these things were already made, why can't I see them today? So his logic was that if you looked out into the universe today, you should find a lot of these heavy elements just floating around in the interstellar dust. You should probably even find a lot of them in the first generation stars, but we don't. We just find a lot of hydrogen and helium, and first generation stars don't have any such heavy elements at all. So he was like, okay, so something, some process must have destroyed it, because today I don't see those heavy elements that were made in the previous life of the universe. So he said, all right, the Big Bang must have been hot, because hot temperatures could have destroyed all these heavy elements. So for him, the same conclusion which he reached, it came for a different reason. Right, he believed in the oscillating universe. Now, either way, both these guys instantly realized something. They were like, wait, if the Big Bang was really hot, where is all the radiation today? It must have emanated a a certain radiation which is completely uniform, right? And that radiation would have started traveling, and it must be everywhere even today. At the you could call it the fossil of that radiation, because they also predicted that since the universe is expanding, this radiation would have cooled off considerably. So today it would be rather a very cool radiation, but still it should be there everywhere. It's this afterglow of the Big Bang. So where is it? And both of these guys asked that question, where is that radiation? Bob, who I think was much younger, younger as a scientist in his career, he got two guys under him who played a significant role in this, entire discovery. So these two guys were Wilkinson and Rolle, okay? And he said to these guys, can you build a detector which can detect this afterglow of creation? Can it detect this really cold radiation? And we are predicting that it has to be in the microwave range of the spectrum, because of how much it has cooled, and therefore it will also be uniform, is what the prediction is. So can you, perhaps build a detector? So these guys get to work. This is Princeton, and this is in the 1960s, okay? So Wilkinson is like this super dedicated guy, and if you read his story, it's like he was like possessed with this idea of the cosmic background radiation, and he never gives it up till the end of his career. He always comes back to it. So he's this really committed guy. And they choose the terrace of the Princeton, Princeton University, and they were like, okay, this is a good enough place, and they, start building this detector on a piece of some plywood which used to be a pigeon coop. And they start building it, and it's essentially the antenna, right? Which is the heart of this entire instrument, is the antenna. And it's a horn antenna designed to detect microwaves. And they were predicting that the temperature of this radiation should be somewhere between 3 and 10 degrees above absolute zero, right? This is the important key parameter that they're looking for. So the temperature of the radiation. Now, how much is 3 degrees above absolute zero? It's bloody cold. It's bloody cold. We are talking like -270 degrees Celsius, right? Now imagine trying to point your antenna up and then detect this really cold radiation while blocking out every other radiation source from Earth. That is, you're trying to detect radiation from space, which is a million times weaker than anything else, any other radiation source on Earth. How do you do that? Especially in 1960, when even semiconductor technology has not even come, and it's honestly medieval. How do you build this thing? But these guys were good. Not at first. I mean, Wilkinson himself says, like, oh, Roel and I didn't know much about radio astronomy at all, but Bob did help us, and we would often discuss. We would run off, build something, and then come back and show him what we've done. So that's how it was. And so they start building it, and they take about a year or two. They work really hard. And one more important part of this entire construction is that when you're trying to measure cosmic background radiation, you need something called a cold load. Okay, because this horn antenna, it already did exist before. So you can ask me, why wasn't it discovered before? I mean, it's just a horn antenna, which was extensively used, like, especially for military purposes back then. But the point is, you need something called a cold load, which I won't go into, but basically, it used helium, which is like at really, really low temperatures, just around 4.2 degrees above absolute zero. So liquid helium was used. And you have to understand that in 1960, liquid helium was like this fancy material that many people did not even know about, or it was rarely used. Okay, so these guys set everything up, and so according to them, this instrument that they are building is the perfect and the only instrument in the world which had the potential to detect the cosmic background radiation. Or at least that is what they thought. So why do I say that? Because because the story takes like a, there's like a twist in the story now, because these guys assumed that they were the only people building this massive instrument and which had actually any chance at all of detecting this radiation from the universe. But what they didn't know was less than an hour's drive away from Princeton University, there was a facility of Bell Laboratories, okay? And Bell Laboratory had built an antenna just about an hour's drive away. This antenna was like this huge guy, and the way you have to imagine it is it's basically like an ice cream cone, okay? And the ice cream cone is like laid on its side, and there is a big opening which is 20 feet in diameter. So that's how you have to imagine it. Now, this weird looking object was actually just a horn antenna, all right? And again, it was used for like defense purposes and such. But Bell Laboratories was like, well, why don't we call a couple of astronomers and maybe they would like to use it as well. Maybe there's some use for them. So they call these two guys who play, again, super important role in the story. So these guys are Arnaud Penzias and Wilson. Now remember, the Princeton University group is Wilkinson and Roll, and this Bell Laboratory group is Arnaud and Wilson. Okay, so Arnaud and Wilson are a great team because they came there as very experienced experimental physicists. They had a lot of background work done already in radio astronomy, and they had a lot of technical skills. Okay, so these guys were good scientists. And when they arrived, they were like pretty excited. They were like, let's study the halo of the Milky Way, do some real radio astronomy. They were super hyped. And this instrument, the Bell Laboratories antenna, was actually initially designed for communicating with the satellite called Echo One. And if you don't know what Echo One is, you should totally Google it, because Echo One is this really cute looking spherical satellite, and it's like a Stone Age communication satellite. It's like the bop, what is bop? Dad. It's like the dad of all satellites that we see today. So these guys are like, okay, let's do some real radio astronomy, right? And this instrument was already tuned for 4,080 megahertz, which is like the frequency that it was sensitive to. And they were like, this is around 7.5 centimeter wavelength that I'm talking about. So they were like, okay, before we change anything and build a new receiver for 21 centimeters, because in radio astronomy, you use 21 centimeter wavelengths. They were like, before we go ahead and build a new receiver, let's just see what this antenna can do without changing anything, right? Which is just 7.5 centimeters. And what they expected was to get no signal at all, because the Milky Way, the spiral arm of the Milky Way gives out no radiation at this wavelength. And except for some noise maybe from within the antenna, they should be getting zero signal, right? So they just turn it on, they point it up in the sky, and guess what they see? So they see this weird fuzzy signal, and this signal is at, corresponds to a temperature of 3.5 degrees Celsius above absolute zero. And irrespective of where they point it, they keep getting the signal. It's completely annoying to them. They have no idea what they've done wrong. And these guys also, you should remember, built a cold load, right? So they're pointing it everywhere, and this 3.5 degree, radiation, it just doesn't seem to disappear, whatever they do. And they are like, okay, something must be wrong with the amplifier. Is there anything else wrong with the electronics? Where is this noise coming from? Is it an internal source of noise? They point it at the horizon, and wherever they turn it, it seems to be constant. So you need to understand what's happening here. Two individual groups, each having no idea that the other group exists, and they are just 1 hour's drive away from each other. build or have access to the same kind of antenna and core load. One group is actively looking and wants to detect the cosmic background radiation. The other group is completely ignorant that cosmic background radiation could exist at all. They have no idea about it or what it is or this afterglow of Big Bang. They don't know about it, okay? But they are getting the signals, right? So this Bell Laboratories, these two guys keep looking and keep trying to figure out where this noise can be coming from. And one day they see pigeons inside the antenna, right? They're like, oh my gosh, like there is a big nest of pigeons there. Of course, these guys, maybe, adding of course, they are going to be pooping all, within the antenna. So, of course, there should be some noise coming from the pigeons. So they get this trap for the pigeons, and I think it's kind of similar to like a mouse trap where you keep some food and then the organism, the bird, whatever, it enters and then it eats the food and then the trap shuts off, right? And then you catch the pigeons. So like, okay, and then they go out, they do some shopping, they buy traps, they come inside. And what they would actually do before this is they would just tip the entire antenna over, like to the ground, so that the nests would fall off. But that didn't work because the pigeons would keep coming back and building more nests. So one day they just used this trap and it worked. They caught the pigeons and then they're like, oh wow, finally. And then they box it to some place which is like 40 miles away through the company mail, And they're like, oh, so glad to get rid of them. And they boxed it 40 miles away because that's the farthest that could be mailed using the company services. So they were like super, super glad to get rid of it. And some guy received the mail and then he set the pigeons free. Okay. So far, so good. They're super happy about it. Then both of them spend 1 hour sweeping the pigeon poop from the antenna. And to Penzias, right, when he sees pigeon poop, he doesn't just see pigeon poop. He sees white dielectric material. And to him, I mean, he's a thorough radio engineer. To him, that is something that can produce microwave radiation because everything on Earth radiates, okay? So this pigeon poop could definitely be the source of the radiation. And these guys were desperate by now. You need to understand, it's almost been a year. And they have not even begun their work because this weird, incessant signal has not disappeared yet. And according to them, it's just noise. Now, of course, I think they considered it could be coming from the universe itself, but it seemed too bizarre. It seemed so bizarre that they never even tried talking about it or verifying it. Because it didn't make sense that the signal could actually be real. So, this entire duration of 1 year, they were looking for a source of noise and they never considered to accept the radiation as something that was actually coming from the universe. So, according to them, the pigeons are gone and then they get back to work. And guess what? In 2 days, other pigeons arrive and start building nests again. So they are exasperated by now. They walk into this machine shop, something. They find a guy over there. The guy is like, yeah, I know all about pigeons. Then he comes there the next day and he shoots the pigeon. Yep, they died for science. So this guy shoots the pigeons, kills them, takes them away. The antenna gets cleaned up, and oddly enough, Wilson always says that no pigeon ever came to build a nest inside that antenna again, ever. So I guess that was the last. So they are like, okay, finally it has to work now because there are no pigeons, there is no pigeon poop. I mean, it has to work. There cannot be that signal anymore. So the next day they point the antenna up to the sky, and what do they receive? 3.5 degrees temperature above absolute zero. The radiation doesn't go away. Now, I mean, first of all, I would like to comment upon how good these two are as engineers, Penzias and Wilson. The precision of how they did the checking, how they tried to debug, how they documented everything they did in that 1 year and how completely tenacious they were in trying to get rid of this noise. I mean, if you are someone who is given a new toy to play with, a new telescope, something, and you find something to be wrong with it, would you spend a year, just trying to get rid of that one noise, that one bug that is kind of interfering with your progress? But these guys were like super consistent. And I must mention this because there was a guy before Penzias and Wilson in 1961 who had already detected this radiation. And he never bothered. He even verified it. He's like, oh, yes, there is definitely a 3.5 degrees temperature radiation coming from somewhere. But he just moved on and he didn't pay much attention to this noise signal. And I say this because often we think like, oh, when something is discovered, it's discovered. But then there are so many little coincidences, so many little slips, I mean, cosmology as a field could have started at least a decade before it actually did, if some people had been as good or as persistent engineers as these two guys were. So that's the point. And they stuck on to the problem. And again, till the end of this year, these two groups, Princeton and Bell Laboratories, did not know about each other's existence. Finally, one day, Penzias makes a call to a friend, okay? And he's still at Bell Laboratories and he makes a call to a friend about something else, an entirely different matter. And he wouldn't have even mentioned this pigeon poop problem had it not been for the other friend to ask him, so, how's work going at Bell Labs and stuff? So then Penzias starts talking about the antenna and talking about this residual noise, the 3.5 degree thing. So this friend guy goes, wait a minute. I think I might know something about this. And he says, I was speaking to another friend of mine who was telling me about some work that people are doing in Princeton, right? And I think there is a group in Princeton who are actually looking for this radiation, which is almost just about in the temperature and wavelength range that you guys are working on. And this friend of him then connects him to Jim Peebles, who is the guy who gave a talk apparently. And Jim Peebles actually worked in Princeton along with this group, with Wilkinson. So basically they get connected with like it's not even a direct connection, it's like you could say there were four people and then finally this guy, Arno Penzias, was finally connected to Wilkinson at Princeton just by pure coincidence. These guys would have given up. These guys would have never documented, published anything. And Wilkinson would have continued, building his detector in Princeton for another year or so. So, yeah, the story is pretty crazy. And finally they get on call with each other. And Wilkinson is just like, holy shit. And then they take a trip to Bell Laboratories and they're like, dude, we've been looking for this from ages. This is the radiation we are looking for, and we are building a detector for it too. And then Penzias and Wilson are just like, well, we've been trying to figure it out and we are just desperate for an explanation, so please give it to us. So as these two groups talk and discuss, they realize that they really have found conclusive evidence for the cosmic background radiation. And even then, the Bell Laboratories group, they were not entirely convinced. Of course, they wanted the explanation, but in the work that they published, they never fully stated that, yes, this is cosmic background radiation. They stated it as a possibility because they knew that what they had found is something that can be, it's a constant. They were sure that this radiation existed, but they were not sure how true the theory was, the cosmic background radiation theory, which had been predicted before. So they didn't, say it with full confidence either in their paper. And eventually the Princeton group went and released their own paper, Which, by the way, had a lot of controversy a bit later on, because there was, you know how I spoke about George Gamow in the beginning of the talk, and I said Gamow was this guy, he predicted the cosmic background radiation. Well, the Princeton group never gave him credit in their paper, okay? And you must understand this is a breakthrough paper that the Princeton University group wrote. Because they wrote about the evidence, they wrote about the data. They were writing a statement saying, yes, we have verified the existence of this radiation. And in that paper, they did not write the Gamow's paper as a reference. They didn't even mention his name. So there was a lot of controversy there. Gamow got mad. He was like super disappointed because this is literally that paper gave birth to cosmology, and Gamow was the first guy to predict the cosmic background radiation. So, as the story goes, it gets weirder and weirder, honestly. I mean, pigeon poop is not the best part about it. It gets weirder, but then I'm not going to go into that. I guess this is where I'm going to stop. And the Bell Laboratory group went on to win the Nobel Prize a couple of years later, and they won the Nobel Prize for being the ones who detected the cosmic background radiation. And the committee which, gives these Nobel Prizes decided it would be too controversial to give the Nobel Prize to people who had predicted it. So instead of giving it to the theorists, they gave it to the engineers. So that's what happened. And eventually, the scientific community accepted it, and it grew. It actually exploded into this new field because suddenly there was so much possibility. When you have this afterglow of the Big Bang, you are literally getting photons which started their journey 14 billion years ago, and they are now reaching you. And by looking at something called hot spots or cold spots, you can tell whether there were fluctuations in the beginning of the universe. And all the large scale structures you see today, galaxies, stars, supermassive black holes, these large scale structures must have come from very small initial fluctuations in density back at the beginning of the universe. And the cosmic background radiation, it holds the clues for such anomalies, which is why the study of anomalies or anisotropies in this radiation is a field in itself. And when you study it, you truly understand where all the large scale structures come from. And but for a long time, it was a huge mystery, because the more they studied cosmic background radiation, the more smoother it seemed. It's the most consistent and uniform radiation source that we know of today. And it comes from all directions, and it is everywhere in the universe. And by detecting the intensity, or how many photons for cubic meter per volume, you can tell the strength of this radiation. And although it's very, very cool today, it carries a lot of information about that period of the universe, where it was extremely hot and extremely dense, where radiation dominated the universe. This is before 300,000 years, right? 300,000 years is the time when the universe became transparent to cosmic background radiation. So, anyway, this branch, this domain of study is super exciting, mainly because the more you study the cosmic background radiation, the more you understand why the universe seems the way it is today, right? And like I was mentioning, for many years they didn't find any anisotropies, and in the first time they discovered small anisotropies, one of the scientists said it was like seeing God, because that's how important they are. And imagine you're seeing so many density fluctuations today, right? You see big lumps of matter. All that must have come or originated from smaller density fluctuations. Imagine if you're not able to detect those fluctuations at all. It seemed smooth. It is directly telling you that today's universe should not exist. Imagine looking at the relic of the Big Bang, and the clue it gives you is that your reality is wrong, or the universe shouldn't exist the way it does today. That is scary shit. So when the scientists eventually did find anisotropies, for them it was like seeing God. And I think even today, if you study it as a science, and if you study it to truly understand how the universe works, it really is like seeing the mind of God. And cosmology is the most audacious of all the sciences out there, because it's a bunch of humans, advanced apes, sitting in a room and making confident statements about what happened in the universe 14 billion years ago, making confident statements about where we come from, not just as a species, but as a universe, the birth of the reality itself. And therefore, it's a courageous field. And some of these stories behind such big discoveries, I think it's really, really important to appreciate the people and appreciate these stories. So anyway, I'm gonna stop here because I think I've been talking for like ages and I'm like super hungry. Next episode, next Wednesday, maybe, maybe. Okay, bye.